This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehis Wuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The video of five plain-clothed officers as they brutally arrested Yusuf Kawoya sparked outrage in Uganda.
That's Halima Tumani reporting from Kampala. Details coming up also. The Ethiopian government yesterday signed a peace deal with a previously outlawed organization. The European Union today allocated $8.3 million to groups fighting the Ebola outbreak in eastern DRC. And President Paul Biya has been declared the winner of Cameroon's October 7th presidential election. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, Uganda's security forces are under scrutiny after a video was made public last week showing plain-clothed officers brutally beating and arresting a civilian on the street. Uganda's army spokesman says the troops are facing a disciplinary committee, but the family of the victim says they are not being told what happened to their relative. Halima Tumani has more from Kampala.
The video of five plain-clothed officers as they brutally arrested Yusuf Kawoya sparked outrage in Uganda. Each armed with an AK-47 rifle, the men in broad daylight grab Kawoya in the street. As he falls on the road, the unknown security men pounce. One man uses the butt of his rifle to repeatedly hit Kawoya in the lower abdomen before he is taken away. Kawoya's sister, Sharifa Nachitende, says since the assault last Thursday, her family has not been able to get authorities to tell them why her elder brother was arrested or where he is being held.
The trauma that is in the children, the fear, and our mother, all the family members, they're in shock.
The biggest fear is my brother may not be alive. He was badly tortured.
After the video of the beating and arrest was made public, the Ugandan army and police forces initially denied any knowledge of the five security men. But on Friday evening, army spokesman Brigadier Richard Karamire released photos of the men appearing before a disciplinary committee. Without identifying the men or their unit, the five were charged with conduct prejudicial to good order and discipline. The army says they pleaded guilty to the charges, which carry maximum punishment of disgraceful discharge. Army and police spokespeople have refused to comment further on the matter, saying it is before the court. But the brutal arrest left many Ugandans like Anthony Mukalazi in shock.
The manner in which a fellow Ugandan can be arrested, we had gotten used to sticks. Now if you come and you arrest and you're thumbing people with guns, it shows the level of impunity that the country has. So it was really heartbreaking. And as Ugandans, you cannot be sure that you'll be safe the next time someone comes to arrest you.
Kawoya, a businessman, is a member of the opposition People Power Group, created by musician turned opposition politician Robert Chagurani, better known as Bobby Wine. Wine was himself arrested in August, allegedly tortured and charged with treason, along with other opposition lawmakers. Authorities accused them of throwing stones at President Yoweri Museveni's car. Human rights lawyer Nicholas Opio says Ugandans are living in what is nearly a rogue state.
You're only alive because nobody wants to kill you. Every single day, there are countless stories of innocent civilians who have disappeared in the hands of gun-wielding, non-uniformed individuals. I think for me, it's the shadow state. It is a very dangerous practice whose sole intention is to instill fear, whose sole intention is to target regime opponents.
Opio says the rest of the world needs to know that the pretense about Uganda being democratic and civil is no longer believable. He says foreign powers that supply weapons to Uganda need to question whether their support is being used to violate human rights. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
In another step towards reducing ethnic tensions, The Ethiopian government yesterday signed a peace deal with the Ogaden National Liberation Front, ONLF. It had previously outlawed the organization as a terrorist group. The ONLF began fighting for secession for the Somali region, also known as Ogaden in eastern Ethiopia, in 1984. Earlier this year, the Ethiopian parliament removed it from a list of banned movements as part of a reform led by Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, who has extended an olive branch to opponents since taking office earlier this year. The ONLF declared a ceasefire in August. The two sides will form a joint committee to discuss the roots of the conflict in the region, which is rich in oil and gas. Another sign of reform, an Ethiopian marathon runner who made global headlines with an anti-government gesture at the 2016 Olympics has returned from exile. Family and fans greeted Olympic silver medalist Fayisa Lilesa at the airport, along with Foreign Minister Workan Hagabayo. The runner held his arms over his head, wrists crossed, as he finished second in the Olympics in solidarity with protesters in his home region of Oromia. Afterwards, he felt threatened by the previous government and sought asylum in the United States. When it came into force in 1987, the treaty known as the United Nations Convention Against Torture represented a milestone for human rights activists. Since 2006, 87 countries have signed on to the Convention on the Prevention of Torture. It's overseen by a 25-member committee dedicated to ensuring that detainees in member states are not tortured or subjected to cruel, inhumane, or degrading treatment or punishment. To find out more about the committee's work, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with its chairman, Sir Malcolm Evans.
We live in a complex world where state actors are often tempted to resort to violence to quash dissent, and where detainees also often suffer from neglect, mismanagement, and lack of funds. But Sir Malcolm Evans says that the idea behind his committee's work with member states is relatively simple to understand.
We've got the right to visit any place of detention that we choose to go to interview and speak to detainees, see what conditions of detention are like, how they're treated.
Under the terms of the convention, those reports remain confidential unless a country permits their release to the public. This offers a face-saving way to put things right. But without the risk of public embarrassment, couldn't governments punish detainees who allege torture and abuse? Evans says no.
We take the question of sanctions and reprisals against those people who speak to us hugely seriously. The legal instruments, the conventions, provide clear obligations that no one should suffer any sanction or reprisal for speaking with us, and that is something we insist upon.
It is impractical for the UN to investigate each detention facility in all 87 signatory countries on an ongoing basis. That's why, crucially, all parties to the convention are obliged to set up their own domestic investigating committees within 1 year.
So on a day-to-day basis, there are independent monitors, inspectors going into prisons, police stations, psychiatric hospitals, immigration detention centres in many, many countries around the world and many, many countries in Africa, speaking to hundreds, if not thousands, of detainees, getting a real picture of what is going on and being able to make a very real difference to those responsible for the running of the place.
Evan says that globally, 12 nations have failed to meet this obligation. Seven are in Africa. They include Burkina Faso, Burundi, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Gabon, Nigeria, and Liberia.
I myself will be heading a delegation returning to Liberia in a fortnight's time to see how they're progressing in relation to this following our previous visit some years ago.
Sometimes a simple innovation can help remedy a situation where detainees are at risk. For example, prisons and detention centers are often dangerously overcrowded, creating inhumane conditions. In some prisons, up to 70% of the detainees are accused of a crime but have yet to be arraigned or put on trial. In Africa, That can be due in part to a lack of reliable roads and transport, and a shortage of security guards to safely convey detainees from the facility to the courts.
So we've suggested such a simple thing. Well, why don't you take the judges or the magistrates to the prison and set up a temporary courtroom in the prison where you can process these things? If you can't take the person to the court, take the court to the person. Some have done that. And as a result, the numbers being held for prolonged periods pre-trial has fallen significantly, overcrowding has reduced, and everyone benefits from that. It's just one very simple example. We're just sometimes thinking a little bit out of the box and then try to put people on the spot to say, well, why don't you do it? There is a solution to this problem.
The Committee to Prevent Torture's 2018 report calls special attention to the plight of migrants in detention, who often lack the benefits and protections detainees native to the country enjoy. Committee Chairman Sir Malcolm Evans observes that migrants are often stereotyped by the public or viewed as mere statistics by policymakers. He says that humanizing migrant detainees by telling their personal stories of struggle and flight is now a key part of the committee's work. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
Cameroon's longtime leader, Paul Biya, has been declared the winner of the country's October 7th presidential poll. Opposition parties are rejecting the results, but the Constitutional Council has already thrown out petitions to nullify the election. Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Suffrage en faveur de chaque candidat. Biya Paul, Diamaré.
This is the voice of Clément Atangana, president of Cameroon's Constitutional Council, reading election results on Monday. According to the results, incumbent President Paul Biya won a landslide victory with 71% of the vote. His strongest challenger, Maurice Kamto, was a distant second with 14%. Seven other candidates scored vote percentages in the single digits. Voter turnout was 53% nationwide, but much lower in the volatile northwest and southwest regions where government forces have been fighting separatist movements. Biya won more than 80% of the votes cast in those regions. John Gute, Biya's close aide and minister in charge of special duties, said he is not surprised at the president's victory. He says Cameroonians are aware that Biya has done much for them and is ready to do more for the country's development.
Paul Biya, we know, the man who is very persevering, the person who is very patient, the one who is very honest and who is candid and who tells Cameroonians what can be done and what is not possible to be done. The man who is peace-loving and the man who wants good for Cameroon.
Angry protesters came out singing that Biya had stolen Maurice Kamto's victory, but were quickly dispersed by heavily armed troops. Augusta Bate supports Kamto.
We want justice. We should not only preach democracy, we should practice it as well. The presidential elections, even Biya knows Kamto won this presidential election, so he should just let him take over power.
Joshua Osi of the main opposition Social Democratic Front, who finished fourth in the election, says he does not recognize the election results.
History holds it that one head of state using the entire government, army, police, and state resources to maintain himself in power. History holds it that what happened on the 7th of October 2018 was worse than anything witnessed before. It was everything except an election.
Last week, Cameroon's Constitutional Council threw out 18 petitions filed by Kamto, Osi and others demanding the election be nullified. The opposition parties allege widespread irregularities, insecurity and low turnout, especially in the restive Anglophone regions, but the court ruled there was not enough evidence to throw out the results. Biya has been in power for over 40 years in Cameroon, 7 as prime minister, 36 as president. In 2008, he removed term limits from the constitution, allowing him to serve indefinitely. He is now the second oldest president in sub-Saharan Africa. When his new term is finished, he will be 93 years old. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
You are listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Twenty past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Uganda's security forces are under scrutiny after a video made public showed officers brutally beating and arresting a civilian on the street. The Ethiopian government yesterday signed a peace deal with a previously outlawed organization. And Cameroon's longtime leader, Paul Biya, has been declared the winner of the country's October 7th presidential poll. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. The European Union today allocated $8.3 million to groups fighting the Ebola outbreak in eastern DRC. That brings its total aid for this outbreak to nearly $15 million. The announcement comes after rebels with the Ugandan Allied Democratic Forces attacked Beni, the epicenter of the outbreak. They killed at least 12 civilians and kidnapped 15 others. World Health Organization officials warn that the violence in the region where several rebel groups operate increases the risk the outbreak may spread. Health workers have been threatened because the disease is unfamiliar in the region. Many residents resist containment efforts such as safe burials for Ebola victims and monitoring of their contacts. There have been at least 237 confirmed or probable cases and 153 Ebola deaths in the region, which is near the border with Uganda. In Nigeria, the Kaduna state government has imposed a 24-hour curfew in Kaduna town and surrounding communities because of fears of reprisal attacks following days of sectarian violence. More than 50 people have died in fighting between youths in the city and neighboring areas since Thursday. The national government has deployed special forces to the region in an attempt to restore calm. Residents say clashes broke out between Muslims and Christians in the area on Thursday, and they escalated until security forces were able to get control Sunday. The region has seen periodic violence over the past decade among different religious and ethnic communities. There are fears it could escalate ahead of the national elections coming in February. Obstetric fistula is both preventable and treatable, but a number of factors mean most women in Africa suffer delays in getting treatment. Reporter Gift Agiriga from Abuja, Nigeria, recently visited some fistula treatment centers in northern Nigeria. She takes a look at some of the challenges patients face.
Rural northern Nigeria can be isolated and impoverished. At the Gambo Sawaba Fistula Center in Zaria, doctors say poverty is often the biggest obstacle for women who need treatment. Most women and girls who are victims of obstetric fistula live far away from the nearest hospital, and transportation could be too expensive. Dr. Adamu Husseina, the principal medical officer, says patients need to be able to pay for their food during a long hospital stay.
Many of them that cannot feed themselves. Sometimes if they come and you tell them, you are staying in the hospital, it will take you so and so weeks to months, depending on how the surgery goes. They will not stay because of food. So food becomes an issue. It's not the hospital that feeds them. They bring their own food items unless we have assistance.
An obstetric fistula is a tear between the vagina and the rectum or bladder, usually caused by a traumatic childbirth. The tear allows body waste to leak continually, so victims often are shunned by their families and neighbors. Nigeria accounts for nearly 40% of the world's obstetric fistula cases, which also are known as physical vaginal fistulas. That's partly because so many young women give birth far from hospitals without trained midwives. Dr. Hussaina says the center has seen a drop in aid from charities whose contributions are usually time-bound. The Gambol Sawaba Fistula Center can handle about 47 patients, and that usually is not enough. It struggles with power outages and a lack of supplies. While waiting for surgery or while recovering, patients get counseling on how to cope with health issues and how to have healthy pregnancies. And the hospital has a mini vocational and rehabilitation center. The young women can learn skills like bead making, sewing, and soap making to enable them be self-reliant after they leave the hospital. The patients use rugs to protect themselves from staining wherever they sit because they cannot afford adult diapers. But the nurses at the hospital say the rugs leave the patients at risk of infections and sores. One patient, Lami Sada, says most patients cannot afford their basic needs in the hospital. She says she is treated well here. She arrived here alone and without enough money to buy food and toiletries. That's the challenge she faces. Some people used to bring food for the patients, but they do not always come around as often as they used to. Dr. Stephen Baturi is a fistula surgeon and consulting gynecologist at the Barau Dikko Teaching Hospital in Nigeria's Kaduna State. He says his hospital doesn't often see fistula patients.
Oh, we don't see patients a lot here because of the charges that we charge patients when they come for surgery, because this is a tertiary center and it's not a designated review center. Most of the sufferers are paupers. They don't have the resources to pay for the surgeries.
He appealed for support from aid organizations and the government to allow the hospital to care for fistula patients. For VOA, this is Gift Agiriga from Abuja, Nigeria.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the sunny side of sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Wojtek Zorniak, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Linor Mudu, host of Health Chat. Next week on Health Chat, we will take a look at health systems with our guest, Dr. Margaret Crook, Associate Professor of Global Health at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The U.S. country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. Health Chat this Tuesday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
VOA News.
When news breaks, VOA News is there. Around the clock, listen to VOA Newscast at the top of each hour, along with our detailed news programs and analysis.
We are online at voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.